From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away for one more week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, the fallout from Brexit was marked by plunging. Plunging markets, plunging pound, plunging politicians. Among them, Prime Minister David Cameron. He ran on the promise of a referendum on whether to leave the EU, assuming it would lose, and then fell on his own sword.
The British people have made a very clear decision to take a different path. And as such, I think the country requires fresh leadership to take it in this direction.
Boris Johnson, columnist and ex-mayor of London, led a fire and brimstone campaign for Brexit, and the Brits assumed he'd ride his win to 10 Downing Street. But on Thursday, he bowed out after his erstwhile ally, Justice Secretary Michael Gove, flatly stated that Boris wasn't up to the job. "No," said Gove reluctantly. "It had to fall to someone else." To Gove, in fact, poor Boris.
My friends, you who have waited faithfully for the punchline of this speech, that having consulted colleagues and in view of the circumstances of Parliament, I have concluded that person cannot be me.
Now a little more on Johnson. In 1989, after being fired from the Times of London for fabricating a quote, the Daily Telegraph sent him to grey old Brussels to cover the dull old EU. Martin Fletcher, a writer and former foreign correspondent for the Times of London, held a similar post in Brussels a few years later. He said Johnson's work in Brussels really livened things up.
He set out from the word go to create a sort of cartoon caricature of Brussels, full of scheming Europeans who were creating a super state that was trampling on ancient British liberties, forever foisting ridiculous rules and diktats on the long-suffering British people.
One of the headlines his stories generated was, "Brussels recruits sniffers to ensure Euro manure smells the same?"
Yes, the first paragraph of which read, "The smelly farmyards could become an offence under Brussels' plans to quantify maximum permissible odours." I mean, as far as I can tell, that was made up out of whole cloth. But it's an example of how he portrayed Brussels as meddling in the minutest corners of British life.
How about this headline? "Italy fails to measure up on condoms."
Yeah, the first paragraph of which was, "The Italian rubber industry is falling foul of EU rules by making undersized condoms." I mean, you can see why people read the stories. They just happened to be completely untrue.
These were stories that had no basis.
There was a kernel of truth in what he said, in the sense that the EU was very bureaucratic and it did sort of meddle more than it should probably in the affairs of its member states. But beyond that, his stories were a grotesque exaggeration.
And why did he write them?
First of all, he was writing for The Telegraph, which was the sort of house newspaper of the Eurosceptic right at that stage. And secondly, because Boris has always had a somewhat tangential relationship with the truth. You know, there was a lot of Euroscepticism around before Boris went to Brussels. He didn't invent it, but he elevated it to a whole new level. And what happened was other Fleet Street editors who were rather bored with this grey stuff that had been coming out of Brussels up to that point started pressing their own correspondents to match Boris. And so you started getting stories in other tabloids about how the European Union was going to ban double-decker buses or force our fishermen to wear hairnets. I don't make this up. I followed him in 1999. And even on the Times of London, I felt under pressure. We were all under pressure. Not only was there a demand for these preposterous stories, but you couldn't write about the European Union's many achievements.
Can you give me an example of a story that you really felt was important but couldn't get in because it didn't fit the template?
How the European Union secured the peace in Europe, how it enabled younger generations to live, work, travel anywhere in Europe in a way that my generation could only dream of. I mean, that's a huge advantage, a very important aspect of our relationship with Europe, which never got reported. Actually, we have a lot of allies. We won the argument on competition policy, on creating the single market, on eastward enlargement of the European Union. There are lots of countries that agree with us. You would never know that from reading the British press. Editors in Fleet Street could only see Brussels through a certain prism, and those narratives were so strong that politicians couldn't challenge them.
You wrote in your New York Times op-ed that Loughborough University's Center for Research and Communication and Culture calculated that 82% of newspaper articles about the referendum favored Brexit.
Of Britain's national daily newspapers, only three, the Financial Times, the Guardian, and the London Times, favored Remain. The rest favored Brexit. That included the Telegraph, the biggest broadsheet, the Daily Mail, the biggest mid-market paper, and the Sun, which is the biggest tabloid. And when I say favoured Brexit, all balance, all sense of fairness, all sense of truth, frankly, went out of the window. It was a thoroughly mendacious campaign, whipping up anti-immigrant sentiment. So people say that newspapers don't matter, but I think they were critical in this referendum. The margin between the Leave and Remain camps was 1.2 something million votes. In other words, if just a little over 600,000 voters had voted the other way, then we would still be staying in the European Union.
Mm-hmm. And according to one opinion poll that was carried out in the wake of the Brexit decision, more than a million people regret their vote to leave the European Union. So that would have swung the vote the other way.
Look, the papers perpetrated four big lies. The first was that we send £350 million a week to the European Union. The real figure is about £120 million. Secondly, that Turkey was about to join the European Union, and therefore millions and millions of Turks were going to be invading Britain. Any sober observer of the situation would be amazed if Turkey joins in the next 20 or 30 years. I mean, it's becoming increasingly authoritarian. Its chances of joining are minimal. Thirdly, that we could somehow retain access to the single market of 500 million people without also giving freedom of movement to European Union workers. I mean, that just isn't going to happen. And fourthly, that our social services were being stretched to breaking point by all the immigrants who have come to this country. Actually, most of our social services, especially the National Health Service, is kept going by immigrants.
Because they pay taxes?
No, because so many are working in the NHS. Without immigrants, the NHS would assuredly collapse.
In the wake of all the criticism of the way the Brexit campaigns were covered in the last week, has there been any kind of mea culpa from outlets like the Daily Mail and the Sun?
No. The Prime Minister had resigned. The pound had plummeted. Global stock markets had plunged. The UK had begun to unravel. And the only people who were celebrating were Trump and Putin and ISIS and Marie Le Pen in France. So what was the headline in the Daily Mail? It was Take a Bow, Britain. And in the Daily Telegraph, it was Birth of a New Britain, as if none of the calamities that had begun to befall us had happened at all. The other thing you're hearing now is, well, both sides were telling untruths.
Ah.
The Leave camp says, well, the Remainers were telling untruths, and they were accusing them of what was glibly described as Project Fear. The Remain camp couldn't trumpet the virtues of the EU, because the EU is unpopular. Even I think the EU is badly in need of reform. So not being able to talk positively about the EU, they had to rely on issuing warnings about what happened if we came out of the EU. So it was, in a sense, based on fear. But the only thing I would say is that all the dire predictions of what would happen if we voted for Brexit are coming true as we speak.
Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Martin Fletcher is a writer and former foreign correspondent and editor for The Times of London. So, last Friday, in the first flurry of stories about how the Brits were reacting to the vote to leave the EU, one anecdote seemed to capture the zeitgeist perfectly. We used it. Even John Oliver used it.
Some of the most Googled questions in the UK since the polls closed last night. What does it mean to leave the EU, and what is the EU?
That is clearly not good. On the list of all-time bad morning after Googles, that's got to be up there with what is a swastika and also how do you remove a tattoo?
The story fit the narrative of post-referendum panic voiced by people like this.
I would go back to the polling station and vote to stay, simply because this morning the reality is actually hitting in.
The notion that the Brits were submerged in buyer's remorse because they hadn't known what they were voting for was irresistibly distilled by those anxiously Googled questions. But it turns out it didn't mean what we thought it meant. The source of the anecdote was Google Trend Analytics, which software developer and data analyst Danny Page warns is often taken out of context.
If there's 200 people searching that term on a daily basis and it spikes up to 600 or 1,000 people, that could show a huge spike. It's 3 times, 5 times. That sounds like a lot more people. But if you didn't know that it was only 200, if you're lacking that particular context, something like 500% more people searching for what is the EU is going to seem newsworthy.
So why not just type EU into your search engine? Why the question?
As opposed to just putting in a topic like EU referendum, it seems that a lot of people might form it in a question like you would have to do for a Jeopardy answer. So who is Mitt Romney or what is the EU referendum is just how people sometimes use Google.
Actually, only 1,000 people created that spike. So never again will OTM lean on Google Trends for an easy headline. We have been schooled. Coming up, transparency in the body politic. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This presidential election demonstrates a stunningly obvious truth. Money does not inevitably translate into votes. But that's presidential races. Local elections can be bought. And in terms of real impact on our lives, these are the elections that matter the most. The Brennan Center for Justice analyzed data from 6 states, Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Maine, and Massachusetts, and tracked the rise of outside spending, that is, money gathered and spent independent of the campaign, after the High Court's Citizens United decision opened the floodgates to anonymous cash. Here are the Brennan Center's 2 key findings. 1, dark money, meaning we don't know where it came from, surged in these states by 38 times on average between 2006 and 2014. In fact, even more than in national campaigns. And 2, on average, only 29% of outside spending in those states was fully transparent in 2014, down sharply from 76% in 2006. Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center. He says that as state house reporters dwindle, we all have to pay more attention to our states.
Decisions made at the state and local level affect everything under the sun. And so much of the explosion in unaccountable big money has actually happened at the state and local level. You don't need to be a Koch brother to be a kingmaker at the local level. It's just a lot cheaper.
It can be as cheap as $100,000.
Or even less for a county council race or something like that. And scrape away the layers of secrecy. Dig deep into who's really paying for these campaigns. Very often it's some business that wants a permit. Some firm that wants to buy a utility commission or affect an attorney general. The grubby, old-fashioned, transactional campaign finance obscured from the public by the ability to do this dark money spending.
Distinguish for me between dark money and something that the Brennan Center calls gray money.
Dark money refers to undisclosed campaign contributions and spending, very often through basically phony nonprofits.
Citizens for Citizens.
Citizens for Citizens, Gray money is a phrase we coined to describe a new and disturbing phenomenon. Even the much reviled and appropriately reviled super PAC have to actually disclose who's giving the money. But when you look closely, many of them get their money from other PACs who get their money from other PACs. Even Sam Spade would have a hard time figuring out who's behind some of these super PAC ads.
Wow. I love the story about John Swallow, the former attorney general of Utah.
Who is on trial for something else. John Swallow was a candidate for attorney general of Utah. And it turned out that a lot of the funding in the race secretly came from payday lenders, so they wouldn't face scrutiny from the state attorney general. About a $450,000 donation for TAC ads that were really coordinated with his campaign.
Sean Reyes, skirting the campaign laws. Not the ethics we need for attorney general.
He knew it, and the company knew it, just the public didn't know it. In Wisconsin, hundreds of thousands of dollars were poured into a state legislative race, and it turned out it was from an out-of-state mining company targeting the legislature because they didn't want to give speeded-up mine permits. This year, we're all mesmerized by the presidential election. You had Jeb Bush blowing through $100 million in super PAC money. So people look and say, see, maybe all this worry about big money isn't really as bad as people thought it was. But it turns out when you go one or two levels down where there isn't this white-hot national scrutiny on the election, not only is money having a massive impact on elections, the spending of the money is much more often in secret.
I mean, we are talking about quid pro quo, the exact thing that the Supreme Court Citizens United decision said you had to prove. You could prove it again and again in these local elections. But the problem is, as your study points out, these are low information races. A citizen isn't even likely to know the name of a candidate that's running. And if the citizen does, chances are they will have heard it through an ad.
We need to know who's paying for the ads so we can know who's influencing policy. When the Supreme Court issued the Citizens United decision in 2010, they said, well, all this spending can't possibly be corrupting for two reasons. One is it's all disclosed, and the other is it's really independent of these public officials. And I always like to quote Chico Marx, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? You know, that's not the real world any of us live in. First of all, we know the spending very often is not really independent, whether it's sharing consultants, secret meetings, or even a wink and a nod. The other thing is, increasingly, it's not disclosed at all. It wasn't only Citizens United. It was a web of other decisions. It was the fact that the IRS has not been cracking down on these phony nonprofits.
And the FEC is fully staffed and up and running, right?
The FEC has been in gridlock for about 30 years. The Federal Election Commission was designed not to work. It's three Democrats and three Republicans. Right now, the Republicans are simply on strike. They are refusing to do anything and enforce any of the laws. So bit by bit, the edifice of campaign laws has been allowed to evaporate.
Do you think people really care about transparency?
It's pretty clear this year that voters are angry about a system they see not working for them. They feel, as we hear from people in all different parties, that it's rigged. Citizens United is probably the most single unpopular Supreme Court decision in both parties in decades. So at the federal level, there was legislation brought to the floor of the United States Senate after Citizens United to require disclosure of much more political spending. And it was filibustered by the Republicans. You are starting to see in some states stronger laws. California has had a big explosion in spending by outside groups, by PACs. It's got very tough disclosure laws. And so there's very little dark or gray money in California.
Do you think that this will happen at the local level first or on the state level and then finally percolate up?
In the United States, change often comes from the states first. There is a great deal of voter agitation about these democracy issues, ballot initiatives on campaign finance, where the public is really ahead of the politicians. And there's even actions that could be taken right this second at the federal level. President Barack Obama could sign an executive order requiring all federal contractors to disclose all their political spending, including donations to nonprofits that are really fronts for campaign ads. He could do this executive order, and he still has the cap on the pen. I think everybody should be asking these politicians as they're running for office, what are you going to do about dark money? What are you going to do about gray money? What are you going to do about the role of money in politics? This is our chance in these months before the election to try to bring some sunlight into the process through our votes.
I do believe I see stars in your eyes. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice. The center's new report is called Secret Spending in the States. Transparency advocates scored a big win in Washington on Thursday when President Obama signed into law the FOIA Improvement Act. It could very possibly make the Freedom of Information Act work more like it's supposed to. Since its birth on July 4, 1966, FOIA requests have soared, and wait times for documents can last literally years. Before Bob went on assignment, he spoke about the imminent changes to FOIA user and watcher Jason Leopold.
You're usually a dependable FOIA curmudgeon filled with frustration and sometimes rage at how the government thwarts your reporting despite the 50-year-old FOIA law. But do I detect that you have a certain spring in your step?
Indeed, I'm smiling. You know, the bottom line is this. The FOIA Improvement Act will make it easier for the public, for journalists, for historians to gain access to information.
In what specific ways?
It codifies into law the memorandum that President Obama signed on his first day in office instructing all government agencies to act with a presumption of openness. When in doubt, release the records. There will be a centralized web portal where requesters can file their requests online and track their requests. So it makes it much more efficient. Another really, really important change is a change to an exemption in FOIA that pertains to the deliberative process, internal communications that go back and forth between various government agencies. It's been the most used and abused exemption. So part of that exemption that deals specifically with internal deliberations, there's a sunset provision that is lifted after 25 years. So we can go back now to, say, 1991 and start requesting some documents from the Justice Department, from the Department of Defense, looking at how policy related to the first Iraq war, how that evolved, what was discussed there. I mean, this is a boon for historians. This is a big win for the president, who did come into office promising a new era of transparency and open government.
What's a little odd is the intervening almost 8 years. It was the president's opening salvo in the Oval Office, but his agencies, notably the Justice Department, have done everything they can to stymie this legislation and have a FOIA fulfillment record that is pretty horrendous. It's kind of like Obama administration multiple personality disorder.
It's true. There's an office within the Justice Department that's supposed to be the FOIA cop, if you will, ensuring that all the other government agencies are abiding by these guidelines. They've done a terrible job. What the FOIA Improvement Act will actually do now, however, is strengthen the Office of Government Information Services. Now, that is an office where the FOIA Ombudsman is located. And the FOIA Ombudsman really did not have any real powers before this legislation was passed. Now, however, the Ombudsman, who is nonpartisan, will ensure that all other government agencies are complying with the law.
One place we still really can't get any satisfaction is the legislative branch. In fact, in its statement supporting the legislation, the White House took a shot at Congress for continuing 50 years into the history of FOIA to exempt itself from requests about its own business.
We'll never see Congress subject to FOIA. I will say that it would have been amazing if the law did apply to Congress, particularly in this presidential election cycle. Could you imagine the records that we would have been able to obtain and take a look at with Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, even Senator Hillary Clinton? But it's probably because of what takes place behind the scenes that Congress said, not us.
Jason, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
Jason Leopold is senior investigative reporter for Vice News.
Coming up, more about transparency, but not in the body politic, just in the body. This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So maybe the FOIA Improvement Act could usher in a new era of government transparency. There are still plenty of dark corners where big decisions are made that affect us, one of which is science. Scientists who rely on attracting funders keep their discoveries secret until publication so they're not scooped. Biologist Kevin Esvelt, leader of MIT Media Lab's Sculpting Evolution Group, says this culture of secrecy is not only inefficient, it's dangerous. Writing in Nature this month, Esvelt urged the scientific community to open all experiments to public scrutiny, beginning with the revolutionary and potentially world-changing gene editing research he helped advance. Kevin, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for the invitation.
So let's start with CRISPR. It's a stunningly easy way to edit gene lines. I mean, grad students can do it at home, right? How does it work?
So CRISPR is best thought of as a molecular scalpel that can be programmed to very precisely cut, and therefore to edit, any DNA sequence. And it works because when you cut a DNA sequence, the cell needs to fix it, because the next time it replicates, it needs to have made another copy.
So how can you use it? Why is it good for mankind?
Well, what it means is that we can cut a gene that we want to edit and introduce an edited version of that same gene. The cell will use our version to repair the damage. In other words, it makes CRISPR a bit like a pencil. It lets us erase the original sequence and write in a new one.
And thereby cure certain diseases?
So lots of bloodborne or immune diseases where the immune system isn't functioning right or it's under assault by something like HIV could potentially be fixed by editing a fraction of the cells to make them immune to the disease. And then those cells could replicate and make up for the ones that are not immune.
We usually think of an organism's genome as being half mom and half dad. And this principle limits CRISPR because if you were to, say, alter the genes of one mosquito in order to prevent the spread of malaria, and then you took that mosquito and released it into the wild, those changes wouldn't show up in all of its offspring. Maybe half of them would inherit them. And maybe that genetic change would be naturally selected out of the population over time, right?
That's exactly right. Whenever we edit an organism, we have to keep in mind that we're tinkering with something that has evolved to optimize reproduction in its ancestral environment. That is, the environment that that species evolved in. Anything we do to it is probably going to break something important for that. Because remember, we're altering it for our benefit, say, to block malaria, not the mosquito's benefit. So what that means is that whenever we alter an organism, we tend to assume that natural selection will eliminate our changes over time.
Mm-hmm. So now let's move on to your big innovation, CRISPR-based gene drive systems. You realized that with CRISPR, you could change the genetic destiny of an entire species.
That's right. We could cause a CRISPR edit to spread through a wild population if we simply encoded the CRISPR pencil next to the edit. So in other words, you're teaching the organism how to edit genomes on its own.
So theoretically, we could use a gene drive system to, say, eradicate malaria by introducing just one genetically altered mosquito into the population?
Yes. It takes a single organism to potentially spread that change to the entire population.
Now, the reason why we're talking about this on the media is because we care about transparency. And it really bothered you when the U.S. National Academy of Sciences released a long-awaited set of guidelines for conducting gene drive research this month and left out the one that you've strenuously advocated for, which is transparency. Why is it so crucial in this case?
We as a society now have the ability to alter ecosystems. We can do it together, slowly, carefully, humbly, with collective scrutiny to keep us from making mistakes. Or we can do it behind closed doors, and scientists can ask people to trust them, despite the fact that they're choosing to do their work behind closed doors. We will not only be safest, but we will be able to do the most good if we do everything in the open. What's more, I don't think that there's a moral alternative. I want people who ideologically object to the very notion of altering nature in any way, I would love for those people to take a close look at exactly what my group is working on and proposing to do and try to find anything they can think of that might go wrong. And if they succeed, if they find something that we can't invent a way around, we can't make it safe, then the project has to halt. And that's as it should be. Right now, scientists do not tell anyone what they are currently doing and planning to do in the laboratory. I think the system would be better if all research was done in the open. Gene Drive is the place where we must start. Everyone should have an opportunity to share their concerns and criticism when it comes to technologies that will impact all of us. And we would be foolish to dismiss concerns simply because someone doesn't have a degree.
You recently met with a couple dozen Nantucket, Massachusetts residents to seek permission for a CRISPR-based experiment you wanted to conduct there, which would aim to diminish the transmission of Lyme disease. You're not worried that by sharing the design of your study with the public, you've also invited scientists in the field to scoop you?
By being so open about it and receiving media coverage about it, it will now look bad if anyone else does. So to some extent, we are free to take the first step and be rewarded for it. What's hard is for the next person coming behind us.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is a little pie in the sky. How do you change the tide of money flow?
Well, if funders require that proposals requesting money to perform experiments be made public, that would get us most of the way there. Most science is funded by the government, taxpayers. And given that, why is it done behind closed doors, which does not benefit taxpayers?
So because this kind of research changes everyone's environment, you want the whole public in on it. And you know what happens when you do that. I mean, genetically modified anything causes an instinctive clutch reaction in a lot of people. And how do you get past that?
Much of that reaction is precisely because research in genetically modified organisms did not offer clear and obvious benefits to most people. It was not done in the open. Safeguards were not clearly discussed in advance. And, of course, it was done largely by for-profit companies that people had other reasons to be skeptical of. In our discussions with the citizens of Nantucket and the Board of Health there, we did see a very different response to a project that would be nonprofit, done in the open, with the communities making all of the key decisions, where the research would be tested, what kind of resistance to Lyme and other tick-borne diseases would be engineered into the mice. We observed a very, very different response from what you typically see when you bring up genetically modified foods.
There seems to be a delicate balance here between the need to educate the public, include it into the discussions about gene drive systems, earn its trust, and the fear that the more people know about the technology and tinker with it, the greater the risk. So how do you mitigate the risk on both sides?
It's a great question. So what am I afraid of? Well, I'm not particularly worried about ecological risks. That is, in fact, I was surprised at how most of my ecologist colleagues are not particularly fazed. Even though this technology can be used to suppress populations or possibly even eradicate them entirely.
Like getting rid of mosquitoes completely.
Well, there are 3,500 species of mosquitoes in the world, and 6 of them are responsible for the vast majority of human disease. 2 are invasive in most of the world, and the other 4 are responsible for a child dying roughly every 4 minutes.
From malaria.
Yes. But there's only a few diseases in the world where you have that kind of moral urgency. The only thing I will say is that I don't get a vote because I'm not affected one way or another. It's the people who do live there that are going to have to decide. Because make no mistake, our civilization is not sustainable. We must continually invent solutions to make the world a better place. We need popular support for that. Why should people trust scientists who insist on doing their work behind closed doors?
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Esvelt leads the MIT Media Lab's Sculpting Evolution Group. So secrecy has left scientists with a serious image problem, especially those who tinker with genes, because it seems like a short hop from mosquitoes to mice to people. Cloning, for instance, is a rich source of anxiety, especially when Dolly the Lamb was cloned by Sir Ian Wilmot on July 5, 1996. Got any plans for the 20th anniversary? Naturally, science fiction has dug deep into clones, from Blade Runner to Boys from Brazil to The Island to the underrated Moon, go see it, and of course, BBC America's Orphan Black. The show's characters include Sarah, a British grifter, Allison, a soccer mom, Cosima, the science geek, and Helena, a stunningly unpredictable assassin. And lots of others, all clones, all far more nuanced than I could describe. All played by Maslany.
We're clones. We're someone's experiment, and they're killing us off.
Their self-styled clone club pursues answers about their mysterious creator, desperate to secure their autonomy and save their lives. In his new book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Clone Club, bioethicist Gregory Pence uses the universe of Orphan Black to probe the thorny ethics of cloning. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as a bioethicist, you are pro-human cloning, which I take it is not a mainstream view among bioethicists?
No, I am a lone wolf, kind of an outsider when it comes to cloning.
We're so used to imagining clones as commodities, soldiers or slaves or the source of spare body parts, and there are plenty of filmic depictions of all of that.
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto. Rachel is an experiment, nothing more.
Some hag trophy wife needs new skin for a facelift, or one of them gets sick and they need a new heart, they take it from you.
We modified their genetic structure to make them less independent than the original host.
I prefer to think of being created by cloning as a delayed twin. And we've had delayed twins. We've had 2 embryos who have split, and one was implanted 8 years after the other. And anything that's true about a delayed twin would be true of cloning. So if we created 2 versions of Taylor Swift from her embryo, we couldn't just kill them and use them, you know, as a commodity.
And this is because of the principle of non-discrimination by origins, a phrase that you coined, right?
Yes. It basically says that the way you were originated, whether your parents were married or whether your sperm and egg met in a test tube, really doesn't matter to your human status. And therefore, you can't be killed for your parts. People had exactly the same fears, including some Nobel Prize winners, about the first test tube baby, Louise Brown. And as soon as the baby was walking down the street with her mother in a pram, people said, oh, it's just a baby. Oh, how lovely, because it was in England. And all that stuff about the scares just kind of went away.
So you think the same thing must and will apply to clones because that's just the way humans are? We think babies are cute?
If a child was created by cloning to someone who is, say, aspermatic or just all the other ways had failed, that child would be very, very highly wanted. And this is where the rub comes ethically, not only just as a baby, but for those specific characteristics.
That's a big rub, yeah.
Yeah, it is a big rub. It's called the argument for an open future, the idea that every child should have an open future. And if you clone LeBron James, then everybody's going to expect him to be a basketball player, not a rabbi. But people still have free will. Expectations aren't necessarily destiny. And the Pacific Rim, they kind of see our almost puritanical fear of cloning as a chance to get ahead of us.
We know that the evil people in Orphan Black are the people who devised the experiment that brought these clones into being. One of them is someone named Aldous Leakey, which is a kind of compression of Aldous Huxley, yes, who wrote Brave New World, and Leakey, the famous anthropologist.
I'll be able to offer you the ability to see into a spectrum never before seen by the naked eye. Infrared, X-rays, ultraviolet. You interested?
Maybe I'll just start with basic LASIK.
And so you should. That's making an evolutionary choice. Neolution gives us the opportunity at a self-directed evolution. I believe that's not only a choice, but a human right.
Are you agreeing with him, Dr. Pence?
No. There's a tension in the show between getting the facts right and being dramatic. And unfortunately, the evil scientist in the show provides the drama.
But I mean, do you believe the basic impulse to improve ourselves through science?
Yes. I just walked here from across the campus and went by Children's Hospital, which is a major, major hospital for the Southeast. Probably about half of the kids in there suffer from some genetic condition, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs. If you could eliminate those problems, it would alleviate a huge amount of human suffering. There's a gradient between eliminating terrible genetic defects to improving people. But once you open the door to choice, I think it's going to be very hard to say, well, you can choose this, but you can't choose that.
But you're not afraid of opening that door?
Not given the kind of conditions I see in the kids in Children's Hospital. We have a man here at UAB who has a cure for sickle cell in mice, but the NIH and other people won't let him try it on humans because they're so afraid that something might go wrong.
On the other hand, you can't be experimenting on human subjects who might suffer even worse as a result, right?
Well, I think you can if they voluntarily consent and they're educated and they've experienced sickle cell in their own families and know what it can do in their carriers. Otherwise, we basically have to say, oh, we're done. No more medical progress.
Okay, let me make a distinction here between messing around with genes to make us more disease-resistant or healthier and cloning. IVF babies are one thing. Cloning yourself is another. It's yuckily narcissistic, it seems. Everyone remembers the 1978 film The Boys from Brazil, which essentially brings back legions of Hitler.
He had denied himself children because he knew that no son could flourish in the shadow of so godlike a father. But then he heard what was theoretically possible, that I could create one day not his son, not even a carbon copy, but another original.
Jawohl!
I don't think you necessarily have to say that any child originated by cloning would be someone's narcissistic fantasy. You know how people go out to the sperm bank in Los Angeles and the women kind of look through the different guys? I think that's a more realistic and plausible scenario.
It's curious. We often talk about the media on this show as being a reflection of ourselves, kind of a mirror.
Yeah.
You see something similar at work in the way cloning critics think about cloning.
Yes, I think cloning is a kind of Rorschach test for our fears about parental choice and scientists gone mad.
The deepest needs we want fulfilled with another human being, right?
Absolutely. The two dominant pictures of cloning in the media are someone who fits a certain stereotype of female beauty, and another stereotype is of the warrior, men who are going to just basically follow orders and be super soldiers. One of the problems for the media in using these stereotypes, it tends to make you ignore the more substantive issues ethically about money. In Orphan Black, some of the more interesting points are about people patenting DNA, using stem cells as medicine for people, and how powerful the desire for profits. That, in some ways, is the more interesting story.
And Cosima, she's the scientifically minded clone, talks about precisely that.
A patent? We're property. Our bodies, our biology, everything we are, everything we become belongs to them.
As you point out in your book, whether a part of a living organism can be patented is the source of an extremely thorny legal debate. So why don't you kick that off with a brief description of the 1980 Supreme Court case, Diamond versus Chakrabarty?
So the question was whether a novel organism that was created by Chakrabarty, which basically ate oil and converted it to something nice, could be patented. And the court said, yes, this is a novel invention. The person who created this deserves to have some revenues from it. But if you take that further, then you start to wonder how much of the human DNA can be patented.
And that takes you to 2013. The Supreme Court ruled that they couldn't patent the human gene related to breast cancer because it was simply a discovery of something that already existed in nature.
And the court saw rather quickly something that might create a whole human and be patented. People really don't quite know what to do about it. Ultimately, I'm not sure how much we can control. We certainly ought to see it coming.
Explain to me why you decided to write this book about this show.
Orphan Black is one of the very few shows I've ever seen who treats beings created by cloning in a dignified, natural way. They're not commodities. They're not zombies. It tries to get the science right, at least in the first three seasons.
They're very clear on their own individual identities.
We're all messed up. Except you, Sarah.
I'm the biggest mess there is, Allison.
No, because you say F it. I tried to say F it today, and I blew up my whole life.
My name is Rachel Duncan, and we are going to come to terms.
It's a double blind. The monitor's unaware of the purpose of the experiment. That way they can't skew the results.
First I eat, then we fight.
The show gets this absolutely right, that small differences in surrogate mothers or what the mother ate, parental upbringing is going to be a major factor in how people turn out and the particular culture they are raised in, whether they're raised by Ukrainian nuns or on Long Island as a soccer mom.
Now, I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of your book. Clones are not, strictly speaking, identical. Identical twins, despite a lot of really flashy twin studies, are not even so identical. And you explain why, that there are variations on the molecular level and variations in how parental genes are expressed. You don't necessarily get a 50% expression from your father's gene in a particular trait and 50% from your mother. They could vary even if you have identical genes.
Yes, and whatever package of genes we have a different response to different environments. So if people are starving, one kind of expression comes out in our genes. If we're full of food, kind of don't have to work very hard, our genes might be expressed another way. That's basically the backbone of epigenetics. Our genes can turn this way rather than that based on what's going on, not only in utero, but in childhood and the whole rest of our life. We're just starting to understand that, though, and that is a huge, huge project.
And now let's get to the stickiest wicket of Orphan Black, the question of sexual and gender orientation and identity. It isn't just about a science geek clone and a soccer mom clone. It's about a gay clone and a trans clone. If our sexual identity and orientation is pretty much decided by our genes, then are they walking into a particularly murky landscape here in Orphan Black?
Well, I must say, Brooke, this was one of the most delicate issues to research and write about in the book. One of the ways we know about twins is there's a reunion every year in Twinsburg, Ohio, and some identical twins, one person is heterosexual and one's gay. So that's pretty strong evidence that pretty much the same genes because of epigenetics or childhood influences can be expressed in different ways. So the show is just basically validating what people already know.
We started this discussion by noting that you're basically in favor of cloning. In 2000, you were the lone bioethicist to testify before Congress against bills that would have criminalized human cloning, right?
Yes, they wanted to make it a federal crime to create both reproductive cloning and embryonic cloning.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to create some of my own cells and make it into my medicine, or maybe Michael J. Fox wants to do this and drip it into his brain to help Parkinson's, I don't see that's a big deal. I really don't. Reproductive cloning, then you're creating a baby, which is ethically different territory than creating stuff.
Would you testify before Congress in favor of reproductive cloning?
Sure.
You would?
Using IVF in 1977 was an unethical experiment, but it became ethical to try it. So we might want to still have the tool around. If we made it a federal crime or if we say never, I think that's a mistake. We just don't know what the future holds. Let's just leave it out there and see what happens with gorillas and chimpanzees. Maybe one day there will be a reason why we would want to try it.
And you have enough faith that human beings won't
mess it up?
Yeah.
Basically, I trust parents that they're going to want the best for their children.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gregory Pence is author of What We Talk About When We Talk About Clone Club. Do you have a favorite clone?
Helena.
Me too!
Everybody loves Helena. She's kind of like an intercontinental ballistic weapon that Sarah can unleash anytime she wants. You want me to kill them?
You want me to kill them.
What have they done to you? Are you okay?
I'm most wonderful.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Litsitsina. We had more help from Emma Stelter, Isabel Christo, and Micah Lowinger. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. You'll hear Bob's dulcet tones next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.